I'm so excited to tell you about Delete Me, the sponsor of this podcast. Have you ever Googled yourself? It's so frustrating that things like our name, email address, phone number, and even the list of our relatives are being sold online by data brokers. This poses a considerable threat to our privacy, especially if our personal info ends up in the hands of scammers or stalkers. I wanted to put an end to this, which is why I went to joindeleteme.com and signed up for Delete Me. Delete Me's privacy experts comb through the countless data broker websites looking for places your data shouldn't be, remove it, and send you a report on what they've done. They do this all year round, so I don't have to think about it. Since I opened my Delete Me account, I feel better knowing my info isn't easily available online to be used against me for fraud, harassment, or identity theft. You can get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/protect. Go to joindeleteme.com/protect. That's joindeleteme.com/protect.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Hello, I'm Jim Cornell, and this is the WalkingPost.com podcast. WalkingPost.com is the news website dedicated to walking with all the latest on festivals, gear, trails, and more. This podcast is airing on Friday, April the 25th. School's back, so is the rain, but at least it's a bit warmer. I was up in the Loch Lomond Park area to do an interview this week, and of course when I got there, the adapter for my microphone was missing, so I had to improvise. When I got home, I ordered two more online, and when I put the microphone back in the bag that I'd turned upside down already, there was the adapter. One thing I will say, if you're ever up in Scotland looking for a nice drive, do the A85 from Killin to Perth. Amazing scenery, and some lovely small towns and villages along the way too. This week I also got my press pass for the Outdoors Industry Association show in Liverpool in June, which is always enjoyable, unless it's pouring. And I always end up walking past the Magical Mystery Tour bus and find it totally impossible to not sing at least the chorus from the song. Last week on the podcast we talked about a walking festival near Hadrian's Wall, and that's the Haltwhistle Walking Festival. And a bit further away, at least from the UK, we had a chat about the Argyle Ross Trail in Hong Kong. This week we're talking about Guernsey and Eastern Europe, as we have conversations with Sue Welfare about the Guernsey Walking Festival, or at least the spring version, and we chat with Nick Thorpe about his latest book, Walking Europe's Last Wilderness. Before we get to the news, you can reach out with news, press releases, guest ideas, and comments via walkingpost.com, or you can just email me at jim@walkingpost.com. So now, in case you missed them, it's time for our brief look at some of the headlines of the news articles we had on walkingpost.com this past week. And it was a bit of a bumper week in spite of not getting a lot of emails because of Easter. Construction started on the €2 million Wild Atlantic Way Discovery Point in Ireland. Trail grants have been given to community groups in Canada all across the Canada-wide trail, and there is new signage on the Forth Bridges Trail. If you want a very interesting walk that takes in two nice communities and views of the three amazing bridges across the Forth, you need to do that one. Three bridges all built in different centuries, and there are even driverless buses on one of the bridges. Okay, moving along, Rhino Rescue has launched some new outdoor safety products. The first official Mountaineer Mile Trail opened in West Virginia. And it doesn't mean you have to climb a mountain, it's just that West Virginia's nickname is the Mountain State. And the Keithley Walking Festival is looking for walk leaders. Some research at the University of Glasgow suggests that faster walking may be better for the heart, and organisers of the 2028 World Trails Conference are looking for a host city or town. I remember once being invited to a big event when I lived close to Halifax in Canada, and that event was going to be in Cairo, which was wonderful, and I was quite excited to go. Until the venue had to cancel, and then they moved the event to, yes, you guessed it, Halifax. I was not happy. The Marquette Greenway Trail, which is going to run from Chicago, Illinois to Michigan, is one step closer, as the Michigan section has been completed. Funding is available for West Yorkshire walking projects, and you can read all of these articles and more at walkingpost.com. Okay, time for this week's interviews. If you haven't already, please do check out walkingpost.com's front page, where there is a link to all of the different walking festivals around Europe. Every once in a while, I do find another one to add to the list, but I think we've got most of them. One that I found intriguing is the Guernsey Spring Walking Festival. You'd wonder how a small island has a long and big festival, but as you're going to hear from the festival's coordinator, Sue Welfare, there is so much to do on the island and the nearby islands of Sark and Herm. Let's find out some more. I wonder if you could give me a verbal overview of Guernsey, where it is, what it's like.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Guernsey's the second largest of the Channel Islands, the largest being, of course, Jersey. We're situated just under 30 miles from the coast of Normandy in France, which surprises some people that we are so close to France. And we're about 80 miles or so from Poole in England. So that's one of the ports that you'd be able to get a ferry over to Guernsey, the other being Portsmouth. So Guernsey is what's known as a self-governing crown dependency. We're not part of the UK. We're 24 square miles in size, and we've got a coastline of just under 40 miles. And at the moment, a population of about 65,000 people. Now, we have quite a mixed topography here in the island, with the south of the island being much more elevated with stunning cliff paths, a flat west coast with beautiful sandy beaches, a rugged northern coastline with large expanses of common land. We've got areas of quiet countryside and woodland. We've got busy harbours. And there's lots to see in terms of both the natural environment and historical structures going right back to the prehistoric times. And the weather here is quite similar to the UK, although it's generally a few degrees warmer. And spring typically arrives here about 2 to 4 weeks earlier than the UK. And we very rarely get snow. We tend not to go into minus degrees. So even the winters here are relatively mild. It is a very active island, with islanders and visitors taking part in pursuits such as running, walking, cycling, team sports, horse riding, kayaking, paddleboarding, golf karting, motor racing, sailing, climbing, and loads more besides.
Seems like I should be moving there.
Well, it is a great place to live. It really is.
And obviously you have a walking festival, so could you tell me a bit about the history of that?
Yeah, we do. So we actually have two walking festivals. So we have the Spring Walking Festival, which tends to run sort of across the end of May to the beginning of June. And then we have the Autumn Walking Festival, which is mid-September. So both of them run for 2 weeks. So the Spring and Autumn Walking Festivals have been running in their current format for probably about a decade now, although there were other walking events before that. It used to be known as Walking Week, and it was literally just 1 week, but now we have two festivals, each lasting 2 weeks. So it's scheduled in such a way that locals and visitors can enjoy exploring Guernsey and learning a bit about our rich history during, I suppose you'd call them, the shoulder months of the year when Guernsey is perhaps a little bit quieter. And it's a really good fun way to learn a bit about Guernsey and to get out and get a bit of fresh air and exercise as well.
I suppose it's a bit cooler at that time of year as well. You're not in the peak of the hot weather in the summer.
Yeah, not that we really peak in terms of temperature. It's generally quite a mild island. So it does get warm in the summer by all means, but we're generally quite consistent in terms of our temperature here in Guernsey. But it's definitely quieter in terms of the amount of people on the island.
How has it changed over the years? You mentioned it was a week and now it's two.
Yeah, well, I mean, the festivals have remained consistently popular over the years. And I would think that actually they're probably more relevant now than ever with society's sort of increasing desire to get out and explore, to spend time in the fresh air with nature, to learn and appreciate history, spending quality time with other people, and also to reap the benefits for both our physical and our mental well-being. So we do try to offer tours that will appeal to a wide range of people. And we grade our walks as well. So we have easy, moderate and hike. So some routes may be wheelchair friendly. And we also have a couple of tours designed specifically for wheelchair users. So that's one way that they've evolved, certainly over the last few years.
And I wonder if you could explain, you mentioned the grading, but could you explain a bit about the subjects for some of the walks? Because it's a very historic island, I guess, and very has a unique history.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. Well, the way that our festivals are set up, all of our guides here in Guernsey are independent. So they are all fully accredited, but they're also independent guides. So they're free to set their own routes and choose whatever themes or subject matter that they wish to. And each year we get brand new walks and every festival can be completely different in terms of the content. So it can be a real mixed bag, actually, from prehistory, folklore, social history, botany, maritime, military, could be tours about local food, animals, architecture, literature. I mean, pretty much anything you can think of. Now, our guides put a lot of work into researching their tours and a great sense of pride in sharing their knowledge. In terms of administration, I'm the coordinator of the festival, so it's my role to collate all of the walks submitted and create an interesting and varied schedule. As a guide, it's a very exciting event to be involved in, and it gives you the opportunity to create new tours and to meet lots of interesting people along the way.
And I see from the website that some of the walks are on some of the smaller Channel Islands. How easy is it to get around to the smaller islands and to the various walks?
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. It's safe to say that island hopping, as we call it, is a popular part of any visit to Guernsey because we are in such close proximity to the other islands of the Bailiwick of Guernsey, in particular, Herm and Sark. So both are easy to get to by ferry. The Herm boat takes about 20 minutes from Guernsey and the Sark boat takes about 50. So they're really easy to get to, both offering regular sailings from St. Peterport every day. In terms of the Guernsey-based walks, we do usually try to make sure the start and finish points are close to a bus stop or a landmark, and we provide walkers with bus information as well as What Three Words references. We do try to make sure that nobody's going to get stranded and nobody's going to have trouble finding us. We always start and finish somewhere that's easy to get to and get from.
How many people do you generally get taking part in the festivals, and are you able to determine where they come from?
Yeah, so we do ask people generally. So, I mean, we get quite an even split, actually, of local people and visitors on our walking festivals. Our visitors mostly are coming from the UK, France, Germany, the Netherlands, other European countries as well. But actually, sometimes we get people from as far afield as the Americas, Africa, Asia, Australia, New Zealand. One of the reasons being we have quite a diverse working population. So we do get a lot of families visiting. So for a tiny island of 24 square miles, we do have quite a reach, actually. In terms of numbers, I mean, it can really vary from small groups of just a few people to larger groups of 20 or more. Depends very much on the tour and the route, and all our guides undertake risk assessments to ensure that the maximum number of walkers is appropriate for the terrain, for example.
And I guess for some walks as well, you wouldn't want to be in such a big walk that you can't hear what the person leading it is talking about. It wants to be manageable but and enjoyable.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, yeah. If you were doing a walk, say, for example, on one of our cliff paths where you may have to walk single file for some time, it wouldn't be appropriate to have a huge group where the poor person at the back isn't going to have a clue what's going on.
Obviously, if you're getting people for a festival, you've got quite a lot of people at the same time. Is it easy to find accommodation?
Yeah, but there's plenty of accommodation in Guernsey. But obviously, it's always wise to book well ahead because you wouldn't want to be disappointed. We've got all sorts here, really. We've got from camping to five-star hotels, self-catering cottages. There's quite a varied choice. Now, the Visit Guernsey website is probably the best place to look, as well as sites such as booking.com and Airbnb. But no, there's plenty. As long as you plan and you book in advance, it's not a problem at all. We've got lots of different types of accommodation here.
And what's the sort of the distance range of the walks?
It can really vary, actually. So you may, for example, let's say, go on one of our seaweed foraging tours, and that would be on one of our beaches. And it's probably less than a mile of walking because you're mostly just sort of milling around in the same area. But then again, you can go all the way up to a full day hike in Sark and anything in between, really. I would say the majority of the walks are probably an hour and a half to 2 hours, but they can vary quite a bit either side of that as well.
Right. And is there a cost for the walks? And how do the people book?
Yes, absolutely. So as I mentioned before, our guides are all self-employed independents, and they're free to set their own pricing in the festivals. But as a guide, most tours of, let's say, up to 3 hours are around the £10 per person mark. However, walks which might be a bit longer, or they might include refreshments or entrance fees to historic sites and museums, etc., they may be a little bit more. Every walk is priced individually, and the price is clearly displayed on the listings that we have. So some walks may require bookings. This can be done by contacting the individual guide. Others will just be on a turn-up basis. But again, all this information can be found either online via the Visit Guernsey website or one of the paper brochures that we produce, which can be picked up from the Visitor Information Centre in St Peterport. And actually, most accommodation providers will have this information as well. We do also have a dedicated Facebook page called Guernsey Spring and Autumn Walking Festivals.
You mentioned it being a relatively small island, but given the fact that there's so much to see and do there, is it easy to get the themes and get the schedule to be different for every festival?
Yeah, amazingly, there isn't much effort involved in making sure that it's varied. It just always seems to be, because all different guides have different interests. They like to work in different areas, and it's completely up to our guides which walks they submit. Some guides have very specialized areas or areas of expertise or tours that prove to be popular time and time again, so they tend to stick to these. Other guides constantly update their offerings and add new walks each time. So we do try to make sure that as much of the island is covered as possible with a range of walks to appeal to different tastes. The Spring Walking Festival that's coming up soon, so it runs from the 24th of May to the 8th of June. I think we have actually got a tour in every parish of Guernsey. So there's 10 parishes in Guernsey. We've got at least one in each parish, as well as Herm and Sark as well. So it's a really broad offering. And as I mentioned before, lots of different subject matters. And it's really interesting, really interesting schedule.
Do you get comments afterwards on like social media?
Yeah, I mean, it's an important part of being a tour guide and our reaccreditation every few years that we get as much customer feedback as we can. So that could be sort of reaching out to the people who've come on the walks afterwards, just talking to them after the tour, or they may find you on social media and write a nice comment. But yeah, it is a really important part of it, actually, to get that feedback and learn what people have enjoyed, learn what's worked, what maybe hasn't, and then use that to sort of mold your future tours.
Is the autumn one any different to the spring one?
No, not really. There's not a great deal of difference in the Autumn Walking Festival, other than the island looking quite different. So in the spring, you'll be walking among sort of our lovely bright yellow gorse and the bluebells and wildflowers. And in the autumn, you'll be appreciating sort of the beautiful golden hues of orange and brown. So it looks a bit different. There's not a massive difference in terms of the weather. They're generally quite similar, spring and autumn. In terms of content, there might be differences. For example, if it involves foraging or botany, but both festivals are quite equal in terms of, well, certainly in terms of the work, the effort and passion that goes into them, they're equally enjoyable and they're equally as important.
You find that people do both of them?
Sometimes we do get repeat walkers. We do find actually that some guides have a bit of a fan base and the same people do come back. Mostly people will choose one or the other, but you know, sometimes we get people come back for both, and we certainly get locals come for both festivals as well.
Seems like it's an excellent event.
It really is. And it's something that I'm really proud to be part of, actually. When I first started tour guiding, it was such an important way for me to sort of find my feet and cut my teeth and to get over the initial sort of imposter syndrome when I first qualified. And it's a lovely way to explore the island, get a bit of exercise, meet new people, and just to fully appreciate what's out there, because Guernsey is a fascinating little island. There's a lot more to Guernsey than people probably realise. And I would really urge people to consider coming over and visiting us, because you will get a very, very warm welcome.
The only problem with doing these festival interviews is that I want to go and do them all. I've not been to the Channel Islands and always wanted to go, I think mainly because of the TV show Bergerac, and also because of the unique history, including being taken over during the Second World War. It's a fascinating place. Maybe I'll try and go to the autumn version of the festival. If you are looking for information, you can do a search online, and we do have links in the article on walkingpost.com. Next, to an interview about a book that came out just a couple of months ago, and that book is Walking Europe's Last Wilderness, A Journey Through the Carpathian Mountains. It's the latest book of many by author Nick Thorpe, who has lived in Eastern Europe for many years now in Budapest, as he is the BBC's Central European correspondent.
Maybe we could start by telling me a little bit about the new book and the focus for that book.
Sure. First of all, Jim, thank you very much for having me on the podcast. It's a pleasure to be here. So it's called Walking Europe's Last Wilderness, A Journey Through the Carpathian Mountains. That's basically what it is. You know, I've lived for the last 40 years or so in Budapest in Hungary. And the strange geographical thing about Budapest is it's in the center of the sort of teeth of the horseshoe, which is the Carpathian Mountains. They curve interestingly around from Slovakia to the north of where I am now, curving up through Slovakia, touching on the Czech Republic, round, touching on Poland. They actually form Poland's southern border, then curving around the eastern Carpathians down through Transcarpathian Ukraine, so the westernmost reaches of Ukraine becoming Ukraine's westernmost border, and then curving around into Romania, into the region known as Transylvania, which is one of the few parts of the Carpathians many people, especially in Britain, because of Bram Stoker's Dracula novel, have ever heard of. So it's an amazing range with this interesting sort of arc or boomerang or horseshoe shape. And over 6 years, really, I've walked, I won't say all of it, but good parts of it. And that's the other peculiarity, I suppose, of the Carpathians, is that unlike the Alps or perhaps the Himalayas, the Andes, which I've recently visited myself, It's not so much one range of mountains as several ranges of mountains, lots of massifs piled up on one another, which makes it more difficult to write a book about.
When it came to the focus for the book and the subject matter, how did you decide what the subject was going to be?
Yeah, it's a good question, because in a sense, this book is a sequel to a previous book of mine called The Danube, A Journey Upriver, which I wrote more than a decade ago. And that it was very easy to write a book about the Danube. First of all, I decided to travel it the wrong way from the delta to the source. So traveling up the river, but mostly on foot or by car or by bicycle, occasionally by boat. But there, walking a river, you've only got a choice really of being on one bank or the other bank or on the river itself. With the mountains, it was, with this big range of mountains, it was more difficult to decide the actual route or the routes. But the way I solved that was the same way, in a way, that I solved the Danube dilemma, which was, it's a book really about the people I met on the way, with, of course, the mountains as the sort of backbone of the story. So it's not a book for mountain climbers. I realized, because I'm most interested in, as a journalist and as a writer, in the people I meet on the way, the people who live there all the time, I realized that when one climbs a peak, which I love to do, one tends to meet people who've come from a long way away to test their own endurance and stamina, which I admire enormously. And I've met many climbers, long distance walkers on my journeys in the Carpathians, and we've had some wonderful conversations along the way, and a few of them are included in the book. But mainly it's about the Slovaks, the Poles, the Ukrainians, the Romanians, the Hungarians, all the other smaller peoples, the people who identify with a valley rather than with their own nation, that I met on the way. Those were the people I was looking for, and those were the people I found. The other sort of thing I should mention is it's not a single route. I was not trying to emulate Patrick Leigh Fermor or any of the other great long distance walkers over the last century or so who've set out and never turned back until they reached Istanbul or wherever. You know, I have a full-time job as the BBC Eastern Europe correspondent based in Budapest. So whenever I had a weekend or a week or 10 days, I'd set out to walk another bit of the Carpathians, but largely working in a clockwise direction. So working from Slovakia, where the Carpathians begin on the shore, sort of dipping their toes in the River Danube, all the way back to the Danube, but much further south in Romania. So arriving back at the Danube. So it's from the Danube to the Danube. And that's why it's also a sequel to my earlier book about the Danube River.
Was it with the intent that you were going to write a book, or was it more you were doing these walks and then it kind of dawned on you, this is a book?
No, it was with the direct intention from the beginning, about 2017, 2018, when the idea of the book first sort of distilled in my dozy brain. And again, as a sequel to the Danube book was, in a sense, where does all this water come from in this giant river, the magnificent Danube flowing across 8 or 9 countries in Europe? And of course, I didn't really solve that, because when you get to the source of a magnificent river, you discover it's just a trickle. Actually, a river is made from all the tributaries of that river. And in this case, they're all, most of them, not all, but almost all of the water in the Danube is coming from the Carpathian Mountains. You know, the Danube water basin is actually from 19 countries, from Switzerland to Albania. And so the Carpathians, most of that water, a bit flows north into the Vistula in Poland and up into the Baltic Sea, but most of it's gathering from this arc or horseshoe of mountains flowing into the Danube. And that was, in the end, the way I divided the chapters of the book. I imagined the Carpathians as a sort of grand piano, and all the rivers flowing down from the mountains into the Danube as the kind of keys of this grand piano, black or white or yellow or green or blue, flowing down into the Danube. So that was the chapters hop from river to river as I circle around the mountains.
And did that flow come naturally? Or again, did you have that preconceived idea of it's going to be about the people, or was it going to be about the geography, or did you kind of let that come as you went?
I let it happen according to what people told me. And to this extent, there is a parallel with the Patrick Leigh Fermor books, which is that I found that one person handed me on to the next. With all my books, I like to speak the local language. So this is not an Englishman abroad, a bit of a clown in himself, meeting all these strange people he can't really communicate with. I speak several languages myself, not all the languages of the Carpathians by any means, but I'd find people, especially ecologists, environmentalists, people involved in protecting or restoring or rewilding the landscape in each country or in each district. And they'd often say, oh, I know someone up that valley, or you should get in touch with so-and-so up there. And so I was sort of passed from person to person and place to place, which did feel quite authentic. It was very nice for me to make so many friends on the journey. And strangely, now having written the book, I feel like I've only started beginning an exploration of it. I'd like for the rest of my life to carry on exploring these mountains, because I've discovered, I feel, or stumbled across such places on the journey that I really want to go back to as soon as possible.
Do you think that walking is something that enables better conversations or better understandings of landscapes, I guess?
I do. I was struck by something some of my new Ukrainian friends mentioned to me. And the biggest section of walking I did was in 2021 in the mountains, in the Carpathian Mountains in Ukraine, which are probably the wildest, definitely the wildest part of the whole Carpathians, because Ukraine's a much poorer country. And these are places that many of them you can't really reach by road, only by path or dirt track, in a four-wheel drive or on foot or horseback or something. So I met a group of young people, 60 or 70 of them, including the children, who'd set out in the summer of 2021 in Ukraine so just before the full-scale Russian invasion, to turn what already existed for a century as local tracks and paths, often quite well marked, into a long-distance footpath to attract more people to come to visit the mountains. And they said to me that at the moment, their experience was that there's a certain amount of, you know, mountain climbing, walking, long distance walking in Ukraine. But people tended to arrive with their cars, park at the foot of a mountain, climb it, have a picnic at the top, come back down, get back in their car and go back to the city. And what they were trying to do was to sort of open up their own landscape to their own people and to foreigners, I suppose. And that was what they were doing, to encourage people just to walk longer distances and to travel, to reintroduce the idea of walking as a way of life, really, or as a way of spending longer time, so as a way of spending a whole holiday with your family or on your own or with a friend. And you have the same process happening in Transylvania, in Romania, backed by the tourist board and all kinds of organizations in a much more organized way. But I got to know people in Transylvania and Romania who were saying, well, in order to encourage people, you know, if you can prove or claim to be walking long distance, then you can stay for free with us. Or we've got an outside building or a barn or whatever, or a caravan, and you can stay with us for free. So this sense of walking as, yes, people remembering how to explore the landscape without cars and using local transport if you get tired, to maybe do a section by bus, or to get home if you run out of time by bus or train, and building all these long distance walks into that. Yeah.
And you're mentioning about going to the bottom of a mountain and walking up, and then you get places like some parts of Germany and Austria where they have a cable car that goes up to the top and you walk down instead of walking up.
Exactly. There are some cable cars in the Carpathians. In Slovakia, for example, especially, you know, working with the skiing industry in the winter months and then still running in the summertime. But for a lot of the Carpathians, there's nothing like that. And you're more likely to meet a bear than you are another tourist. I think one of the long distance walkers I've met, a very pleasant fellow called Michal Medek, who's a Czech, who has walked the whole of the Carpathians. I think it took him I don't want to get this wrong, but I think you can. It's only 1,500 kilometres, 1,000 miles or so in a straight line. Of course, it's not a straight line. It goes up and down a bit. But I think he walked it in 6 weeks. And some people have walked it, you know, in 6 to 10 weeks, the whole Carpathians. But Michal told me he'd only met 13 people in that time, because a lot of it's very remote, which also explains my own decision to stick to the valleys sometimes and try and meet people that are living there all the time.
You clearly have an excellent knowledge of that region to start with. Did you have to let go of any knowledge or preconceptions when you were talking to people and when you were thinking about the book?
I think I did. As a political journalist, which is my sort of daytime job, I'm obviously interested in national politics, in national identity, but also in local identity. And one of my sort of fears in the book was before I set out, or before I started writing it, was that there's often a conception in Western Europe of Eastern Europe as a kind of poor place where people are constantly fighting each other. And I didn't want to reinforce that prejudice, in a sense. And I was afraid that I might find it was true, even after 40 odd years living here and exploring, you know, what people are saying, the different, I can't remember how many elections I've covered in all of these countries anyway. And to my pleasant surprise, what I discovered was that local identity is actually often stronger in the mountains than national identity. And that, in a sense, the mountains are places historically where people have taken refuge from the tax man or the press gang. They were places, or are places, where people are trying to live independently of the state often. If one reads the history of and the local heroes in the mountains and in the different, you know, and this is true of Slovakia or Hungary or Ukraine or the modern state of Romania, that often the bandits, the kind of Robin Hood figures, were hiding up in their sort of mountain lairs, coming down, raiding the castles, and then redistributing the gold, as it were, that they stole in the castles down. You know, that's a romantic vision of it. That's one change, I suppose. Older people I spoke to often would identify with a valley. I cite one 96-year-old, 92-year-old lady in a small village called Bohdan in Transcarpathian Ukraine, or Subcarpathian Ukraine, depending on which side of the mountains you are, how you refer to it. And she said, oh, she's a Hutsul, which is an ancient people from such and such a village. And her daughter, who's only 78, said to me, oh, I'm a Hutsul from that valley. Right. And so the sort of older people were, the more focused they were, I found, on their own identity being a sort of very, very localized identity. The other big thing that changed in my thinking as I walked these mountains and valleys and as I wrote the book was it changed my idea of rewilding, because it's obviously a very fashionable word. It's happening in the Carpathians as well. And what I'd understood as rewilding before I wrote the book was about reintroducing the beaver or the bison into a certain area where they used to live. You know, you can see cave drawings in Transylvania with bison in, but they hadn't actually been seen in that landscape since the 1870s. And now there are, I think, 8 or 9 herds that I write about in the book. So I imagined it was a kind of piecemeal thing done by well-meaning people from the cities, often by environmental groups, rewilding groups, to restore the sort of top predators into an ecosystem. What I realized as I walked this book was that actually rewilding is something that nature is doing by itself all the time. And that while human civilization, for want of a better word, is sort of eroding with its motorways, with its new roads, by spreading as villages and towns and cities sprawl into the mountains, into the landscape, at the same time, especially here in Eastern Europe, because of rural depopulation, millions of Romanians 4 million Romanians have left their own country to work abroad in countries like Britain and so on. So the land that they used to subsistence farm and pastures, where they used to walk with their sheep, where they used to keep cattle, where they used to have a place, a stone house often, where they lived in summer time, where they planted apple trees and plum trees. Those spaces are increasingly abandoned, and they're being reoccupied by trees as the trees spread down with no animal husbandry there anymore. They're being reoccupied by bears as bears spread through Transylvania. You know, the number of bears is up from 6 to probably closer to 8,000 or 9,000 now, by wolves, by jackals, by lynxes. And so rewilding actually is happening all the time, and it's just a question of for our societies, I suppose, of how we want to live with a growing wilderness. And that's a really interesting question that I'm only just beginning to think about and explore, but there's a lot about that in the book, because there are several encounters with bears. It is an area where there are a growing number of conflicts between humans and bears, normally because of the stupid way humans behave, or the way they panic when they meet something which is as wild as a bear, because there's lots of ways of coping with a bear. If you've thought about it before, if there's any public education campaign on a local level, and if local people are sensibly dealing with their own waste rather than just leaving it out to attract bears. You know, I think a lot of things changed in my mind as I wrote the book, and I hope some of that comes out in the book itself.
Absolutely. Yeah. The title includes Last Wilderness. Are you hopeful for the future of what is clearly an evolving region, but also a relatively unspoiled region, or are you more pessimistic about its future?
I think a bit of both, really. I love the ambiguity in the world as a writer, and I write a lot about the ambiguity, and I think both things are true. I wouldn't want to romanticize the wilderness and say it's easy to travel in, or that it's safe from the predations of man. But at the same time, there are a lot of well-meaning people, including scientists, thinking about this and trying to introduce it into the public debate. You know, I met a Slovak environmentalist called Erik Bolaj, who is trying to, with his movement, which is called We Are Forest, it's working on ways to inform the public, with or without the help of the central state, where to walk, what to discover in nature. He has a program which was accepted by the previous Slovak government and now has been rejected by the incoming, by the new Slovak government. That's a setback for him, to turn the 9 national parks in Slovakia into much more protected spaces. At the moment, there's still a lot of heavy logging going on in those national parks in Slovakia, in fact, an increasing amount, which means that 200 or 300-year-old beech trees, ancient stone pines that can be 800, 900, even 1,000 years old, are endangered by the current government, current forestry authorities in Slovakia. And you have then in those national parks a situation where the forest rangers, who are badly equipped, badly paid, badly financed, not really helped by the state, often without telecommunications to communicate with each other to prevent illegal logging, for example, in those forests, that to turn them from being badly paid, rather grumpy policemen in those parks into, he was suggesting a figure of, if we Slovakia could only find 10 million euros per national park, so for the whole country, 90 million euros, and use that to establish public education facilities in each of those parks, where children, where businesses, where people from all over Slovakia could come, learn about the forest, walk on trails where they're going to be relatively safe, where they can walk and explore those national parks and not straying into areas where bears can still be found regularly and where might be breeding if it's February or March time. So there's a lot of thinking going into both in Romania, in Slovakia, in Ukraine, in Poland, into how to manage that relationship between walkers and the wild in a mutually beneficial way, So I think with enough thought and intelligence and good governance, it can be done in all of these countries. And there's a lot of people in government and out of government and just ordinary members of the public working on this. Another example in Romania, they've introduced, using the latest technology, an app for your telephone called the Forestry Inspector. And so an 80,000 Romanians have downloaded this. And what it does is, if you see a truck loaded with timber, you type in on your into this app the registration plate of that truck, and you can find, in theory, where that truck came from, where it loaded the timber, and whether it's actually in the system, so whether it's illegal or not. And in this way, it's a sort of citizen participation in protecting the last great forests of Romania. And it's working, you know, pretty well, really. You can ring the police, and in theory, the police will come out and check the papers of that truck, and you can find out if it's cut those trees legally or illegally. So there's a lot of good things happening alongside all the bad things that inevitably always do happen.
Were there any highlights insofar as places that you would like to share with other people or that were really outstanding?
I would just list two or three, I suppose. There's a massif in western Ukraine called Svidovets, which is almost untouched. There's a small ski resort on one edge of it, but basically it's a long, almost flat-topped mountain that's quite hard to get to from the small town of Yasinia. And it's one of the most beautiful places I've been on Earth. I mean, I was walking there in June and walking with snow still on the peaks there. The air, there's no town, big towns or cities anywhere. So at night, the sky is just astonishing, the number of stars. It reminded me of being in my youth in the Sahara Desert, when you realize that actually you're on quite a small planet and that the horizon actually is, you almost feel you're going to fall off the planet, because there's so many stars in the sky, and you're as though you're just walking on a small strip of land, and most of what's around you is stars. So that feeling up there, that interestingly and sadly is threatened by what promises to be the biggest ski resort in Europe, with more than 200 kilometers of ski slopes. But fortunately, because Ukraine is so poor at this moment and has been through a war, one of the perhaps is still going through a war, there's probably less likelihood that that ski resort will be built anytime soon. And there's a strong local resistance movement, international resistance movement, to turning that into a skiing paradise for the rich. So that's one place. At the foot of that mountain is the source of both the Black Tissa River and the White Tissa River. I didn't even make it to the White Tissa. The source of the Black Tissa was pretty amazing. And the White Tissa, which is close to where the Prut River rises and many other rivers, that's one of the wildest places that I didn't quite get as far. I didn't actually see the source of the White Tissa. The White Tissa and the Black Tissa flow together on the border between Hungary and Ukraine and Romania and Ukraine to become the Blond Tissa. And then it's a huge river which flows eventually into the Danube in Serbia. But that area is wonderful also for kayaking, I've heard, for walking. You often, in some of those areas, it's the one part of the Carpathians, one would be happy to have a guide with you, but you could do it without if you tread carefully and make a lot of noise to scare away the bears.
Are you hoping that when people read this, that they'll become more environmentally aware?
I am, yes, because much of Europe, we don't have so many wild spaces. You know, there's wonderful forests and wonderful places. One of my sons is just back from the Cairngorms in Scotland. I've walked a certain amount in the Highlands. Another of my sons actually lives near Loch Lomond. So as an Englishman myself, coming from, you know, the home counties, born in Kent, growing up in the New Forest in Hampshire, I'm very aware, as I travel the Carpathians, that the landscapes that I grew up in Britain or in Western Europe, how often, you know, the forests are planted and the wilderness is actually more inside ourselves than actually out there in nature, and it's fairly tame. Many of the places where we like to walk, the woods that we have access to. And so I hope with the book that it sort of raises an awareness of the value of the last old growth forests, even primeval virgin forests. We don't actually have to go to the Amazon, which of course people are boldly trying to protect, as well as other people trying to destroy. There are primeval and old growth forests in Eastern Europe and in Northern Europe, and walking in them, I think it does have a healing experience. I relate in the book a walk with a top Romanian forester, a big guy called Ion Barbu, John the Beard, Bearded John. And he, at some point, this forester, you know, who makes a living from forestry, he says, let's take off our shoes. And so there I am with this giant forester walking barefoot through a forest that's never been cut in thousands of years, and taking great breaths of air. And I think, you know, in this over medicalized world where we tend to go to the chemist or to the doctor for drugs, I think a lot of illnesses and mental trauma could be solved by walking barefoot in some of these woods. I would certainly recommend it to anyone.
Great. So if you're looking to pick up a good read, Walking Europe's Last Wilderness, A Journey Through the Carpathian Mountains by Nick Thorpe is available now, published by Yale University Press. The hardcover is £20. It's nice to know there are still some unspoiled areas of Europe. Let's hope it stays that way. I must be very impressionable, because not only do I want to go to Guernsey after the first conversation, Nick's descriptions make me want to go to the Carpathians as well, even with the bears. It's their home, after all. I did see quite a few while living in Canada, so it's not like I've never seen one before, but still. That is it for this week's podcast. Next week we will be talking to another author about a recent walking book, and I have a choice of two for the other interview, and I've not made up my mind yet. It's like trying to pick a flavour of ice cream. I was hoping to do some filming this weekend, but two things have made that not possible. One, it's going to rain, and two, I have an infection in my nose, which has made it swell. So much so that when I got out of the car in the Sainsbury's car park, the front doors of the store automatically opened. Well, it's not that bad, but it feels like it to me. It will also be May when the next podcast comes out, so time really is flying. I think it's a long weekend too, at least in the UK, and that just gives you an extra day to listen to the podcast over the weekend. So we will be back next week. I hope you enjoyed this week's walkingpost.com podcast, and I hope that you have a great week, hopefully with a walk somewhere, or a chapter or two in a book about walking if it's a wet weekend. So until next time, happy trails! Walking Post from walkingpost.com is an Air Coastal Media Limited production.
When you think boots, you think Ariat. You think comfort from day one and durability to day 1,000. You think steel toes on the job, square toes on the dance floor, with style that owns a Saturday night and still looks sharp enough for Sunday dinner. And through every mile and every moment, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, turn bad ideas into better stories, and still punch the clock come Monday morning. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find your Ariat boots at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.